Welcome to tonight's class. We'll be starting momentarily.
Marshal, that's against the law.
Okay, great.
Hello?
Yeah, I hear you. Hello?
Yeah, we got it.
Okay.
All set with your thing? Okay, Marshal, we're about to begin.
Okay, just make sure the phone is as close to you as possible. Sounds all right so far.
Me? It's right here. It's right in front of me, so.
Okay, perfect.
Get any closer.
Okay.
Okay, so I guess we'll begin. The subject tonight is pretty practical. It's not really abstract, theoretic, not taking up an issue and trying to understand it. It's more in terms of practical guidance. And basically, I mean, of course, whatever I'm going to be saying, I have sources for, but it's pretty much my understanding of the methodology that a person ought to employ in terms of changing one's behavior. It's not that I'm taking it from some source and they said it and I'm just giving it over. It's my understanding that I'll show you the sources that I'm basing myself on, but I sort of put together what I consider to be a program. And, I mean, I've used it myself and I've given it over to some people, and, like anything else, you have to try to understand it and see if it works for you. But people have different ways of going about change. It's got to be suitable to you, even if you like some of the things. In terms of implementing it, you have to implement them in accordance with your capacity. And not everybody has the same capacity for change. That's an interesting kind of thing. Some people, you see that once they understand something, once they see something's important, they're pretty good at going about changing their behavior. Other people may have more difficulty in instituting behavioral change. Just start off that we should accept the fact that that's part of tshuva. That the tshuva is not limited only to specific averos. That is, a specific sin that you're, whatever, eating the wrong foods or a particular avera. It's also, the Rambam is in tshuva, Hilchos Tshuva Perek Zayin, in chapter 7. He says that he has to point it out. Apparently, people have this conception that I only have to be concerned about the things that I'm doing wrong. Okay, talking Lashon Hara, that would be a particular. Although that's the kind of thing which is also a behavioral. That's an interesting one, Lashon Hara. Everybody would acknowledge that it's very difficult to give that up. I'm going to take that particular one up. We can work out a plan how we can avoid talking Lashon Hara. You have to have a lot of tape, you know. I'm just kidding. All right. But the Rambam says that you shouldn't say that tshuva is applicable only to specific averos that contain an action, like zinuch, which would be forbidden sexual activities, or theft, things like that, where you can point to a particular action and, you have to give it up. He says just like a person has to return from these, so too he has to search. So it's interesting. This is, what is the holiday that we're searching is associated with? Pesach, we search. People search, you can see a Jewish household on Pesach. Everybody's so worried. The extent that people go to getting rid of the chametz, right? They search for chametz. But this is the time you have to search also. Searching within. The Rambam says, v'chapesh, that you have to search deo throat, your bad character trait. And a person has to return to tshuva from evil, from kaas, from anger, eva, contentiousness, sinna, envy, pito, frivolousness. That is, obviously, within it, there's nothing wrong with having a sense of humor and joking around, but probably a person, to the extent where it's excessive, and it takes him away from serious concerns, excessive frivolousness. Now this is an interesting one. There is deepa hamamon va'kavod, from pursuit of money and honor. Now, what's sinful about that? It doesn't mean that the person is doing it unethically or illegally. If that's the case, then it would be theft. That's an interesting concept. And you see the extent to which our society is not in sync with the values of the Torah. Because in our society, a person that pursues wealth, the wealthy person is the most, assuming again, he's not a crook. Except for businessmen, that's the most honored person. But if a person is excessively involved in the pursuit of money, then that's sinful. Because tshuva is not merely to avoid specific sins, but if the person's wasting his energies on the things that are important, he's avoiding the kind of pursuit of the true good, that's in a state of sinfulness as well. So that's an interesting thing. That a person has to, when you evaluate yourself, you have to look at these things. Am I too involved in materialism? Honor. People don't get honor in this society by accident, just because they, whether it's politicians, whether it's artists, they're pursuing that recognition and the honor. So, according to the realm, I mean, if a person partakes of that, then that's something which requires tshuva. Interesting. Rizita tamacholo. What does that mean? Pursuing food. What does that mean? What do you mean? Who pursues food? The Rambam is pointing to this as a behavior that requires tshuva. I think what he means, see the way, like in today's society, that's also a thing. It's a cold culture revolving around preparation of food and culinary experiences, FTV programs. It becomes a whole cultural thing. And it's not, he doesn't mean to say people just get together and have these feasts all the time. That's a separate kind of thing that we can all see. And you're just using all your energies in the pursuit of the materialism and gorging yourself. That's not what he's talking about. The truth of the matter is, it could be a person who's not necessarily even overweight, who doesn't overeat, but their mental involvement is in something which has no intrinsic value. It's purely in the world of fantasy. So, but people read magazines and they go to fine restaurants. It becomes a complete cultural involvement. So that if a person partakes of that, then he has to be tshuva from that. He's just listening. He doesn't, obviously he can't mention everything in the world. But we're talking about bad midos, bad character traits that a person has, even though he doesn't do a specific sin. Okay? To be an angry person, to have excessive anger, even if you don't do a particular sin, that itself is a disposition, is a state that is contrary, it's a sinful state. The Rambam is introducing us to the concept of a certain sinful state. A person is extremely envious. Everything within reason, we're all normal. Everyone's going to experience a certain amount of envy from time to time, but someone who is inculcated into his nature, so that's something you have to change from. That's an imperfect state. But however, he makes this point that the difference between doing tshuva for these types of things and doing tshuva for others, which would you say is easier, which would you say is more difficult? What would you say? And the Rambam says that it's much harder to do tshuva. It's easier to control a particular action. I can avoid it. I can, certain foods I shouldn't be eating, I can resolve it. I'll find substitutes. It's easier, apparently, to change, I guess all things being equal. But then he says that these sins, kushim, are much harder than the ones that involve an action. An action you can control, but your whole makeup, your character, to change, to do a makeover, a personality change, that's pretty hard. So we should realize that sometimes the problem of studying these things is that everybody starts to feel guilty. Because everything I mentioned, I'm sure we want everybody to take us to a certain extent. And then you've had you feel guilty and so on. That's not the purpose at all. You have to be realistic about these kinds of things. The Rambam is saying it's very difficult. Also bear in mind, although this is not really the purpose of tonight's shiur, but I don't want to give people the wrong feeling. I don't want to bring up any kind of thing. The tshuva is a process. There are certain averos which it's reasonable to expect that a person can overcome them rather quickly once he's resolved to do so. But then, when we're talking about these things, this is a lifelong pursuit of trying to improve oneself. So you're not going to become perfect overnight in these kinds of things. A person is not going to overcome jealousy overnight just because he heard a shear and he feels bad about it. You'll feel bad about it. You're working on a kind of a few days later, you know, your basic nature will reassert itself. That's part of the problem. That's what I want to address. How do I deal with things that are really part of my basic nature? Your nature is going to reassert itself. shouldn't feel guilt about these kinds of things. That's not really helpful. He should be honest, and he should recognize it, and also be realistic. That's why you need a program for improvement. But that's what he says. He says that when a person is sunk in these, it's difficult to separate from that. Then he quotes the Pasuk, Yazav Rashadar. But by saying that, I think also it should go a certain way towards alleviating. If he's saying it's difficult, then they'll feel big when they're having difficulty with it. That's to be expected. Okay. So what I want to take up tonight is the, is there a practical derech that we can employ? This is something that, you know, that we've given a lot of thought to over the years, fellows that attended the yeshiva. The yeshiva, our yeshiva, Yeshiva Nei Torah, Amasoret, for the women, it's very, very demanding in terms of a derech, you know, emphasis of derech, the approach, the analytical approach. That it's very important to master the methodology. But that's in terms of learning, in terms of understanding. And yet, when it comes to translating all these lofty ideals into behavior, so what is there a derech for that too? It just, sometimes it's sort of assumed, I think this was unspoken. It was sort of like assumed in the early years of the yeshiva that the more we understand, the more you clarify why this behavior is wrong and harmful, so automatically it's going to affect you and you'll just do the right thing. But that's not the case. It doesn't work that way. So, by way of introduction to the methodology that I'm going to suggest, basically, in the world of therapy and psychology, there's two approaches that are out there. Two basic, two general approaches. One is, I guess I'll call the behavioral, that emphasizes behavioral change. In other words, if you're doing certain actions, you sort of force yourself to do the right actions by repeating the right actions over and over and over again. They don't really care why. The emphasis is not so much on why you have to do psychology and your background. The emphasis really is more on training. Just do the right thing over and over again. Then you have the other approach, which is more of the, I guess, the cognitive approach, where the emphasis is understanding. To understand two things, I would say. To understand why it's wrong, why what you're doing is not a good habit or it's not beneficial. And also, the Freudian approach is to try and understand psychologically why you're doing it. That's another, you know, to work, person goes for therapy, goes for analysis, and he goes through his past and so on, he associates for years and years and years, and go on endlessly. But what I'm suggesting is, and some combination of the two. I think that the term methodology really is a combination of the two. For example, first of all, This is another point. This is a very important point. It's, again, by way of sort of introduction, sort of a preamble over here. And that is that I think people make a basic mistake about this. You fail to recognize the significance of habit. A person is a creature, it's true, a person is a creature of habit. And if you want, therefore, to act in a certain way, then make it a habit. You have to, people don't do that. For example, they, you know, from time to time, you know, you see something about how great exercise is, the importance of exercise, in terms of health, in terms of everything. So you have this feeling, and you're convinced now I'm going to exercise because it's so clear to me. You may do it the very next day. You'll do it a few times, and then you'll find that you have an excuse. Well, I couldn't do it today. Then the next day, and the whole feeling dissipates. What was the mistake the person made? The person believed in himself. That's in fact, do not believe in yourself until the day you die. That is to say, it's not going to come from your natural inclination or the fact that you have a certain clarity about something. If you don't incorporate that, interestingly, I know people that have had experiences with illness, serious illness, and you know, they pray to Hashem, and sometimes a person sort of makes a resolution that if God will save me, my whole life will be changed. There's no failure. I realized everything else is so ridiculous that I'm pursuing, and I, you know, how precious life is, and why am I wasting my time? any unresolved, that's a transformational phenomenon. And you'll see that for a few days the person will come to shul, maybe he'll learn, but then you'll see the person a few weeks later, and he's back to the way he was. What happened? Was he not sincere? Not true. He was very, very sincere. He made a mistake. He didn't take that experience and inculcate it into his nature. You're a Christian, and make it happen. If you make it a habit, you'll just naturally, you have to make a habit. Unfortunately, we have a lot of bad habits. They keep manifesting themselves. But you can obtain good habits, but you have to do so by a certain method of training. So, it's not enough to say, oh, I had this thing, I'm going to be a different person. No, that doesn't mean anything unless I see that you're going to go to the next level. How do I take that and make it into a habit? Once I make it into a habit, for example, jogging. I go jogging, but I'm extremely, because I think it's important, I'm extremely disciplined. It's a habit. I have to go jogging. Even when it snows, it rains, not because I have this inspiration. It's because I've made it into a natural, it's a habit of mine. So it's a habit of mine. I'll do it. It becomes a lot easier. If a person has not made it into a habit, then you're relying on a certain inspiration, you're fooling yourself. It's not good. Because your natural inclinations, the resistances, obviously, if it's something you enjoy, you don't have to worry about inculcating a habit of eating a churro crunch. I mean, it's not going to, you'll eat it. You're not going to resist inclined, because that's just a natural inclination. I'm talking about things that you have resistances to. So you have to overcome the resistance and make it part of your nature, then it becomes a habit, then you do it, then it's much, much easier. And to the contrary, then it will be hard to uproot that from your being. Now, let me just give you another illustration of that, because I'm thinking about this. If I was to tell you that, the United States, or you're in Israel, there's an attack, and you have to go out here, to go and go out there and fight the enemy, and you see people, there's no way you could possibly do it, right? Imagine yourself in a battle, in a tank, and people are shooting at you, you'd probably fall apart, okay? So how is it? Who are the ones that do the fighting? Think these people are not, they're ordinary people. In Israel, everybody joins the army. So how is it that, and virtually I think 99% of the guys go out there in battle, and there may be a few cases of a coward who runs away, very rare. Most of them go out there and do what you have to do. So what is the cause of that? Because these people are heroes. It's training. That's the train. You do the drill. You do it over, over, over. I mean, you talk to these people. You may have relatives that were in World War II, whatever, and they're ordinary people now. But you left them. That's what we were trained to do. So when you're trained to do something, it becomes part of your nature. You have to do it. You see how important training is. Training is very, very important. And the problem is that we don't go about this in the same way. You don't go about the acquisition of good mitzvot like a soldier. I maintain that's what you need to do. That you have to treat this in the same way that the army is going to treat preparing you for war. You got to be very serious about the training. And over and over and over again, it still becomes part of your nature. Then when the battle comes, you're ready and you'll perform. Not because you're great, but because you're trained. The righteous person is the one who's trained himself in righteousness and good deeds that made it a part of his nature. See, it's not once that's the case, so it's not so great anymore. It's part of your nature to do it. Now, how do we do this? I want to get into the particularities of it. What is the engine of change? What's the engine of change? Of course, this is something that the Rambam says in a number of places. I'm going to refer to it. You can do more reading on your own. The Rambam talks about this in Hilchos Deos, where this is the subject. He talks about the extremes. You're all familiar with that a person should avoid extremes of with regard to all the character traits. He should search for the golden mean, so to speak, the path of moderation. And Kate that Yargo, how does it go? Obviously, nobody comes into being in a perfect state, that's what he says, and you have to work towards you, have your emotions, your emotional dispositions are in line with moderation. So how do you achieve that? But he says, a person accustoms himself with these good character traits. How? Yasevishalish. He keeps repeating the good deeds. Doesn't sound too exciting or romantic. He keeps repeating those deeds that reflect the path that you want to be on. Repeat. Constant repetition. It sounds a little bit like the behavioral approach. But I'm saying Judaism is not limited just to the behavioral approach. It's not that simplistic, because first of all, you have to have a clear understanding of, of what the right goal, what the right action is, what the wrong action is. But also you see that in Judaism, we also study and understand it, Mishlei. In Mishlei, you study about the way of the lazy person, or this one, the gluttonous. So it's all ideas. So you see, it's important to understand these ideas. You have to, what I'm maintaining is that you need to have the understanding, the concept, the hashkafa, the correct hashkafa. You need to understand why Lashon Hara is bad for you, because that's a big mistake. Emotionally, you think it's good for you. That's the truth. You really derive a tremendous pleasure out of it. So you have to understand why it's not really good for the soul. But merely understanding is not enough. I'm going to show, in my opinion, how the two come together, but I'm just trying to show you how much the Rambam emphasizes repeating good deeds. If you're a stingy person, you can't part with a dollar. So then what's the Rambam's cure? You've got to start the program of giving. Giving, giving, giving. And interestingly enough, he says that it's not so much the quality of the good deed, but it's the quantity. So, for example, let's say you're going to give $100. This is a double. Okay? Before Yom Kippur. That's not bad. That's good. It's a nice one now. All right? So, does it make any difference if I give $100 to a worthy cause, or if I break it down into $20 and give 5 times? Does it matter? Is it all the same? At the end of the day, I have two choices. They're both causes are worthy. I'm not getting into the worthiness of the cause. But, or you'll say, I know what you're going to say. Well, if you give 20 to 5 people, you're going to benefit more people. Okay? You're probably going to say that, so you should do it that way. Okay. But I'm going to remove that option by saying you give it to this tzedakah, and they'll distribute it to 20 people. So that's not, doesn't matter. In terms of the results, it's going to be the same. Does it matter? The Rambam says you should give it $20 or 10, whatever it is. Do it 5 times as opposed to giving $100 one time. Because frequent repetition, that's what, because every time you come to the situation, the resistances are there. You don't want to give. You face them. You overcome them. You're winning the battle. So in order to win that battle and make a change, you've got to keep doing it over and over and over again until it gets easy. You'll get easy, and you can, and now you'll be a generous person. You'll want the cheapskate. If you pursue the program intelligently, you will change your nature, and whereas in the past it was painful, you didn't want to part with the money, you force yourself to do it in the same way. Like, you start to jog. You start jogging, the first thing you do, a half a mile, you're going to collapse. That's it. I can't go further. But you'd be surprised. It's an amazing thing that within a few months you could be doing 10 miles. And there are people that become marathon runners. Why? Because that's the power of repetition, of training. Now, we're using the same method over here. So, again, this is very, very important. That the Rambam talks about people who recognize that they have Deos Ro'os. That's the first step, is to recognize. If you don't recognize you have Deos Ro'os, there's no way to go. But if you do, and they don't go to the, he said they should go to the Chachamim. People who have recognized they have these bad character traits, they should go to the Chachamim, who are the healers of the soul. They should go to the wise people, who are the Rofei HaNefesh, the healers of the soul, and they will heal their illness, with the good character traits that they will teach them, until they bring them back to the good path. Then he says, those who recognize these evil character traits, and they don't go to the Chachamim to heal them, they allow themselves to remain in that situation. Concerning them, the Shlomo said, Chachma Umuta, chastisement and wisdom, Edilim Baz, fools, disparaged. So, that's a very serious thing. I just wanted to quote also, this is very, very helpful, the Shmona Prachim, the 8 chapters which the Rambam wrote as an introduction to Pirkei Avos. And here he says it very, very directly. Know that positive and negative character traits are acquired and reinforced solely through the repetition of the types of conduct that stem from these traits. Repeating these deeds numerous times over an extended period of time. When a person habituates himself to positive conduct, he will acquire the virtues that motivate it. And when he habituates himself to undesirable conduct, he will acquire these faults. For as will be explained in chapter 8, at the outset, a person's nature is neither virtuous nor faulty. In other words, no one is born sadhu. I know in a lot of these books about Gadol and that, they try to paint that as an infant or an early year, they would naturally gravitate. That's not a phrase. The real tzaddik is someone who grapples with his nature and uses his will, his intelligence and his will, to direct his nature. Or faulty. No one's a rasha by birth. But as he matures, he develops habits according to those of his family and those of the people around him. Okay. So now, I want to just give some examples of what I have in mind, how to go about it. This is the background. When I'm thinking, the Rambam over there has put the emphasis on frequent repetition as the engine of change. And without that, you're going to be the same person that you were, no matter how much you've been inspired to want to elevate yourself. But then you don't do anything about it, and you imagine that inspiration will carry the day. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. So you have to have a program. You have to work out a program for yourself. Now, that program, obviously you have to have self-knowledge. Each person should engage in a self, what they call a cheshbon ha-nefesh, in a self-evaluation. Now, to a certain extent you can do this on your own, to a certain extent you may need help from others, whether it's your friend, I mean a real friend, a friend that's honest with you, not a friend that just pats you on the back. Whether it's a rabbi, whoever it is, you can discuss it. You have to approach this like a military campaign, so you have to have a certain sense of yourself and what those things are that you have to work on. Not everybody has the same sense. Okay? Now, how do you go about doing it? What is the combination over here? I have a few examples that, you know, I think they're pretty universal, but, you know, again, we'll apply it to the things that pertain to you. Let's take, for example, the case of Lashon Hara, talking Lashon Hara. So from, you know, just contact with people, everybody is always saying how difficult that is, and we're all, you know, how does a person go about that using this method? Okay? Now, frequent repetition, frequent repetition of talking Lashon Hara, you're going to have frequent repetition of refraining. Frequent repetition of refraining. Okay? But it's not enough to just refrain. You're going to be using the mental process as well. And part of it is to understand what the benefits, why it's so important. What's the psychological benefit? It's an imagined, it's not a true benefit, but the psychological enjoyment that you get out of it. So that if a situation arises, very often a situation arises, where people are talking about something, you can sort of sense that someone's going to be criticizing that. And there's a tremendous desire to hear it. Okay? So what do you do in that situation? Remove yourself from the room. If that happens, continue. Let's say you go to a lot of these gatherings, okay? Just by virtue of that, it's the same thing. You're not giving in to the desire. There's a powerful, powerful desire. Now, along with that powerful desire, it is, I must have that. Every time you have a desire for something, an addiction, in your mind you overestimate it. I gotta have that. I gotta hear that. I must have that. By merely refraining and walking away, it's going to bother you. I want to hear that. But you're away. So by not allowing your soul to derive that enjoyment, that need, you're teaching your soul that you don't really need it. You walk away, you get involved with something else, and then let time do its work. And then you realize, I didn't need it, I'm okay. Merely that thing alone, to deny yourself a certain desire, and then you see afterwards, it didn't destroy me. I'm okay. I didn't need it. Now, that would be akin to giving up smoking. It's the same thing. Like a person is addicted to cigarettes or whatever else he's addicted to. So you have the same thing. You have the desire. You have to have a cigarette. Okay? Or put in whatever else, you know, a piece of chocolate, whatever it is. And when you have that emotion, it comes with a certain conviction. I gotta have it. I just gotta have it. Now, if you, for whatever you refrain, you have a certain amount of pain, but you're training the soul that you don't really have to have it. And when you repeat that a number of times, that's a very good model, by the way. Anyone who was ever smoking, gave up smoking, that's a perfect example. The good there. It may take longer, whatever, but after a few weeks, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. The energy is removed from that area. Of course, you know, if the energy goes, then you start to do some exercise, you feel better about yourself. But you're training your soul that you don't need it. But I'm saying an additional thing here. There's another benefit. Because when you refrain, what you should be doing is analyze yourself. Why do I want to hear that? What is the good for me? Why do I really analyze it? Is it because I have a certain insecurity? And I feel guilty about a certain thing? And when I hear that so-and-so did that kind of thing, it's going to make me feel better about myself. When you analyze that and then you see through that, that doesn't make any sense. Why should I feel differently about myself? You see? Now, if I just tell you this as an abstract teaching right now, you'll agree with it, but it's got to be in real time. It's got to be when you're actually teaching the emotions that you don't. You're rearranging your emotions. When you hear a shear, it affects the mind. But then let's say you heard a shear, and that wasn't her, and it's meaningless, because you're just catering to certain emotions, and it's a complete distortion of reality. It doesn't make you any better. And it's just catering to your insecurity. So you're convinced you have no desire for it. But then a situation comes up, the emotion is still there. You see, you convinced the mind, but you didn't train. You have to train the emotion. And by training the emotions, that's where the repetition. If that happens a number of times, you'll reach the point where you see that it just stems from a weakness that you have. And that, or let's say, for example, let's say you didn't leave the room and you gave into the emotion. Okay, so you failed. You're going to fail. Again, this is a process, and there will be times when you fail. What you do afterwards is analyze. Why did I stay? Why did I listen? What's the enjoyment? And is it really an enjoyment? Do I have any benefit from it? Now, once you see that you really don't have any benefit from it, then you're going to spurn it, and then, of course, you go back to the same routine. You go back to the same routine. That's one example. Are there any questions about that? Understand why you need to hear Lashon Hara. You must understand what it's doing for you. And you got to be very honest about that, because it's probably very petty. And you're going to have to face up to a lot of, most probably it's what I said. I mean, there could be other things as well. There's a certain aggressive instinct. You don't like this person. And it also is, there's another thing you learn about yourself. How much you overestimate public opinion. So what difference does it make that anybody spoke about this person? Now, in your mind, wow, this person's destroyed. But then the person is not destroyed. It's just a figment of the imagination. So when you go through all of these different factors and you have a clearer understanding, you see that you've been fooling yourself and that it's really nothing. And it's a form of foolishness. So when you actually experience that, you free up a lot of energy and you feel much better about yourself that you're not. And you don't feel like you've missed anything because you see what it is. That it's really an imaginary attraction. It's an imaginary pleasure, but it's not a real pleasure. Okay. Well, no, I'm saying that's a good question you're asking. It's good to repress certain things anyway. I wouldn't worry about it. You're not going to get a neurosis from that. That's not what we're talking about. But anyway, you see, if you just do that, he's making a very good point. See, if you just do that, you walk away, you might feel like you're a good guy. You're being dishonest. That's a good point. Where'd you raise that? A lot of times the person will ask a question, I'm going. Then you're denying that you really are someone who likes to hear Lashon Hara, but you're compensating for the loss by making yourself into a big shot. I'm a tzaddik. Okay? But if you do it my way, you'll be another tzaddik. Because admit that you really want to hear it. The only reason you walked away was because of the social condemnation, because you want to feel superior. Then you're denying your nature. That's why I'm saying that it's important to do the mental exercise as well, so that you're totally honest. I'm not better than anybody else. I have a desire to hear this. But I'm not going to give in to that desire. Then I want to know, what did I learn about myself? What did I learn about myself in this situation? Why do I want to... Well, I don't know what the situation is. There's a lot of different things people talk about, but it could be that it's something that pertains to you. So that's the... If you do it that way, then I think that you're changing your nature. You're gaining a clearer understanding of yourself. And you will reach the point where you have no desire for it at all. Not because you're trying to be a tzaddik, because you're just going to lose interest. Because you'll see that it's of no, you see what I'm saying? A person, a perfected individual, who's, instead of looking to feel good about himself because of what people are saying about him or others, that he realizes that that's meaningless. So he's focusing more now, he's forced to deal with the fact of how I truly am. And to gain a certain contentment with how you truly are, and being involved in the reality of what you are. And that I don't need to impress other people. I don't need to read this thing. Why you, even in the papers, by the way, it's very, very good, because it's not good, because the society is corrupt. So it's a society which is filled with gossip. Like in the newspapers, that's 90% of what they write about is the gossip. So why do I enjoy reading about that? You can analyze yourself. What do they gain out of that? You see? Now, once you see that, and you actually experience how petty it is, you're going to lose interest in it. What do I care what he's doing? What do I have nothing to do with me? There's no interest whatsoever. Okay, let me give another example. Ego. I think everybody thinks of that. Okay? Let's say you look into yourself and you partake of too much ego. I virtually everybody probably has that. Okay? So how do you go about correcting that? How do you go about correcting that? It's a big one. It's across the board. Okay, so just to narrow the field a little bit, in what situations does it manifest itself? What are the situations, other than you walk around feeling that you're great? I mean, I'm just talking, where does it manifest itself? So let's say it manifests itself in bread. Let's say the person tends to brag a good deal. By the way, another thing that's very, very important in all of these things is to sort of have a review. Review your behavior. Okay? Like, your encounters. Let's say another thing is obnoxiousness. You tend to be obnoxious or aggressive to people. You're too aggressive. If you've reached the point where you're willing to acknowledge it. Because at first, there's a lot of denial. So let's say it comes out in certain social situations. So you have to learn how it's manifesting itself. You got to get past, well, you have a lot of defenses. Oh, I was just kidding. Now. I was just, I didn't really mean that. So, of course, the first thing you need to have a friend who can point it out. Once you begin to see it, then what you should be doing is trying, then you'll sort of notice when these situations come up, when that impulse to say that is. Yeah, I have to be very, very careful. A lot of the stuff I'm talking about, I mean, I gained from my study of psychology, and from working with people. So, being a teacher and, you know, like, using humor in certain situations, this and that, but a lot of times you'll say something that are insensitive. And what do you mean insensitive? I was just kidding around. I meant it in a good way. Well, then, part of it is, maybe I did, but I got myself in that person's situation. That's a very important tool, by the way. Very important tool is, because a lot of times, you'll find people that like to joke around, and they think in a friendly way, but they say things that are a little bit rough to others, but they themselves are extremely sensitive. So then you can't, I was just joking. And you can't believe it, because this person, if you say the slightest thing, they get very upset. So there's a complete disconnect. There's no, put yourself in the other person's position, honestly. You've got to be very, very honest. And let's say somebody would make that same joke about you. Oh, then it wasn't painful, because it's me, and because I have to, I mean, you have to admit, anything that's troubling to you, you should realize it's going to be troubling to the other person. So, when you become, if you want to be a more sensitive person, you've got to sort to begin to realize what kinds of remarks, the kinds of jokes that you've been making, which you think are harmless, you're beginning to discover that people don't like it. See, now, okay, question. Now what's going to happen is, if you're an honest person, in the course of the conversation, you will, a lot of times I'll have this, there's up the back of banter, and I think of a witty rejoinder, and I got a sense of myself, I got to stop, because in my mind, it could be that the person's going to take it the wrong way. I'll make some mistakes, okay, I'll review it. As you make mistakes, as you review it, you'll get better and better at this. Yeah, what was the question?
Somebody does that very hard for that individual, like himself or herself, actually comes
But the behavior was not enough. That is true. That many people who come off as being very tough and very strong and very self-confident, they come off that way. But inwardly, they're very insecure. And they can't face up to their own insecurity. So because they can't face up to their own insecurity, they compensate by being overly aggressive or appearing to be overly, but putting the other person down. So then you should realize that. If you are engaging in that, why am I doing that? Once you analyze it and once you see yourself and you see in action that that's the reason why I did it, that gives you a tremendous control over it. You'll be able to slowly but surely work to it. Then deal with your insecurities in a rational way. Deal with them in a rational way. Good point. A couple more examples and then that's pretty much, if there's any questions. I talked about the bragging. What about bragging? What about bragging? The same thing. You see, learn in what situations you tend to brag. That is, for example, let's say the conversation was praising somebody about something. And it bothers you, and you feel that you have to tell what you do. Let's say they're talking about something, and it's your field or whatever it is. You see? So you feel that you have to say, you tell some kind of story what you did, and that's going to, because you need the praise of the group. So what you need to do is very, very hard, especially if you have something that really would play well, to refrain from doing that, refrain, and then analyze, why was it so important that this group should hear what I did? Why must I have that gratification? You're convinced, that's a strong one, because group approval is a very powerful one. It's just as powerful as the Washington Hurricane. Just as powerful as desire to hear bad about others. And we have to know that we're aggressive and sadistic and we love to hear bad about others. Even though we so terrible, it's so terrible, you can't stop talking about it, you know. No, that's the phenomenon. That's another thing. It's another thing, and I think that especially religious people don't want to acknowledge this. People don't want to acknowledge. It's very good if you don't acknowledge the truth. If you pretend that you're really, really nice and sweet and you feel so terrible about human suffering. But there is an aggressive streak. Mm-hmm. If there's it's called rubbernecking. Sometimes the traffic slows down. Not because there's anything on this side, but because there's a major accident on the other side, and everybody's got to see. And so how terrible it is, but they have to see. So an intelligent person wants them to do. Why am I so fascinated with human suffering? Why? And it's not an accident. How many movies? Violence is a big one. Well, I mean, let's be honest, because we do have, but I think we do have an aggressive instinct, but I think that in the religious training in the yeshiva, since it is a bad thing, objectively, the people have the sense they feel guilty about even acknowledging it. You should not feel any guilt about acknowledging any emotion that you have. You should not have any guilt. That is not, exactly, we live in a Christian society. It's a very important point. That's where you have the repression. Because since I'm too guilty to admit it, I have to repress it. And since I repress it, it's going to come out in indirect ways. I can't deal with it. The only way is you shouldn't feel guilty. God created you that way. That's the HRA. He created the HRA. And you should serve God with your HRA code, with your good inclination, and with your evil inclination. But it presupposes that you understand how it works. Once you understand how it works, you have it under your control. You can direct it towards the good. So that's the example. And you wean yourself away from the need for that praise. That's like one of the hardest things of all. And that even if you did something, that's fantastic. You don't tell, you have, and you have a tremendous desire to tell. Whatever it is, I don't know, you got a hole in one God, whatever your thing happens to be. It's almost impossible to imagine doing it. There's a very interesting story about this. Have destructive, this emotional need to tell. I have a case from the Chumash. Some of you may have heard it already. The case with Moshe Rabbeinu, when he went out and the Egyptian was killing the Jew, beating up on him, he killed the Egyptian and he hit him in the sand. Okay? So he looked all around, there was nobody there, so he killed him and he buried the body. So nobody knew about it. The next day when he intervenes with the two Jews, they're fighting, and they said, who are you to judge us? Are you going to kill us? Do two Jews that were fighting. He was not the one that Moshe saved. But I'm sure when they left, Moshe must have gone, people got tired, but he didn't have to tell everybody else. But why did he do it? Did he tell? He told somebody and the word got out. This is an amazing thing. Why did he do it? What motivated him to do it? He wanted to now hurt Moshe? Moshe almost got killed. Because the power heard about it, and Moshe had to run away. So what would you say? No, he didn't do it for bad motives. He just couldn't keep his mouth shut. He had to tell. He came home, and he had this tremendous thing. You know what happened to me today? I was out there, and I was being beat up, and mud. This man came home, he's the prince, the power, he saved my life. He couldn't keep it to himself. Did you ever have that experience? You have to tell. Yeah, what he did was, I'm sure he just told one person. He said, one person I can tell. And he made that person promise that he wouldn't tell anybody else. That's why, now for many people, that keeping a secret means I don't tell except one person. You have one, because now I got to tell somebody. And then what happens? Now that person that you told is in the same position you were in. They have to tell somebody. So everybody is in that position, they tell, but only one person. And the word goes up. The need to tell. The need to brag. I did this. You got to tell somebody. But do you? Why? Why? Is that the good? Is the good the fact that people know how great you are? Or is the good whatever it is? You did, and that's good, and whatever it is. If it's something really significant in the realm of Torah, you did a great deed. You did a really great deed. You saved somebody. So why do you have to tell? Isn't it a better deed? If Hashem is synonymous? That's an important thing I think a person should put on their list of we should improve ourselves. You have to know yourself. There is reinforcement in the society. We do give honor to people that do mitzvah. That's true, but let's be realistic. Because the person starts off low lishma, you give a child credit, that's very good. So I'm not saying do away with that because the world comes to exist. But each person, if you have a list of things you want to do, which I think you should have too, you should have this self-review, the areas that need improvement. But the areas you want to work on, you should include among them certain things that you do purely and honestly. Purely and honestly. Because when you're doing that, then it's Hashem. Then it's between God. You're overcoming the desire. You go somewhere where nobody knows you, you do some righteous deeds, and you don't get any, if you can, fit it into your schedule. Most of the time, whatever you're doing, if you're helping the shul, there's always people that are going to know about it. Okay, so then you people don't profile, you don't get to be a big shot about it, and tell others and brag about it. These emotional desires come up all the time. Whenever it comes up, you desist and you analyze, why am I doing this? What's the need over here? Why can't I be confident? And you force yourself to be confident and to enjoy the fact, and you force yourself to give up that guilty pleasure of having others pat you on the back. Every time you do that, you strengthen yourself. Your love of the good, because now it's just the love of the good itself. And you remove yourself from the other, you've elevated yourself. Again, but here you got to be realistic. You got to be very realistic. When you start to improve yourself, you got to be very realistic because you can really harm yourself. You got to work in a steady, intelligent kind of a way. That's why it's good to have because the Chachamim work with people that know these things. It's like a guy that wants, he wants to learn now. I want to learn 10 hours a day and I don't want to waste time. And if you're not ready for that, it's like, use the example of jogging, You're going to get injured if you go too quick, too much too quick. Okay? So those are the basic. I think I've covered, in terms of being insensitive to others, we covered that. To learn about yourself. In what ways am I insensitive? What are those areas where I think in my own mind, I'm not even aware of it, I think it's funny, but other people. So try to understand why you do that. Again, a lot of it stems from insecurity, we'll see. Most of the things we're talking about stems from a certain insecurity and a need to bolster myself by putting other people down. That's a major factor. I need to bolster myself by getting praised by others. And you can wean yourself away from these things. I haven't gone into things, stinginess and this. There's a whole bunch of other, I'm not saying, these are in the forefront and these are the tough ones. But of course, doing chesed, doing acts of chesed repeatedly and so forth, if you're really selfish and you're not inclined to helping people, of course. I'm not going through every particular. I just tried to give an overview. And again, the keys are a good understanding of why would that Lashon Hara film? Study Lashon Hara and see what it partakes of in a philosophical way. Psychologically, why this is appealing to you? The emotion that I must have this, and the program of repeatedly either refraining from doing the wrong thing, and when you refrain from doing the wrong thing, you're analyzing it. Use your mind. Just want to conclude with one other example, which I find very useful. When people insult you, okay, or they say things that are disrespectful. Now, being a rabbi, I'm sure these things that can happen once in a while, you know, you're in there. So, here's a little bit good advice. This happens to everybody. Someone said something that bothered you. It sounded like it was mean. It hurt your feelings. Let time do its work. Time is a great healer. Time heals all wounds. You've heard that. Now, if somebody said something and it was disrespectful or insulting, let's say it's on a Friday night. So immediately you hate them. That's the immediate reaction. This person's evil, because that's how you define evil. Anyone that's nasty to me. Okay. Let time do its work. That is, if you got a minor cut or something like that, so you know it's going to heal. Within a day, 2 days, it's going to heal. But it's only going to heal if you don't scratch it. If you don't scratch it, meaning I don't think about it for that night. I will not think about it. Because now I'm in an angry mood, and I'm just going to be thinking, and I resolve not to think about it. And you can do that. So whenever you can see how your thoughts are going in that direction, I pull away. I resolve not to think about the person, not to think about the thing. And getting something else from home, Friday night, whatever it is, whatever you're doing. You wake up the next day, it's going to be there. But it's already different because it's distance. You've created a perspective. See? The next thing I'll do, now it's already not so bad. The perspective is setting in. I'll analyze why does that bother me. Even if he was wrong to say it. He was wrong to say it. But why is it bothering you so much? What insecurity did it bring out? Is it possible that there's some truth in it? That he's uncovered something that I'm trying to hide about myself by implying that I'm this or I'm that? But think it through. Think it through. And you're right. You're recognizing I do have that thing. You may be wrong for business. What do I get? And the fact of the matter is that somebody could say something which is, so what? What's the difference? Would you get so angry at him if he said it's about a different person? I mean, the act itself is such a terrible act. So within 2 days or 3 days, it's gone completely. And then you don't make a big deal. Now, I might suggest that there are certain times when someone insults you and you have to confront it and ask the person, okay, so here. I'm not talking about that. But you'll see, if you follow this pathway, of instead of getting angry, because getting angry at the person is an attempt to deny it. You see? You're trying to deny the truth of what he said by saying, he's a mean person, he's bad, he's horrible. But why don't you listen and see what it is? Maybe there's something there. Even if the way he put it was completely distorted, but there may be something, maybe he hit upon something, a certain weakness within me that I'm trying to hide. Now I see people have seen it. So I can learn about myself. I use it as an opportunity to learn about myself. So these are some of the examples. Now, just 1 second. I'm pausing over here. Okay. If you have any questions or whatever, I'll be ready. I'm not going to give another share now. I was going to think about something else. But I don't know whether you're in the mood now after hearing this and all. So it's up to you. Be honest. If it's not, remember I spoke about how to make Yom Kippur easier? I had worked out another share. Okay? Obviously, I wouldn't have given the share. We spoke recently. We never got time. I wanted to get, if I give this year after Yom Kippur, it's not going to be. But I had also looked at some, this is again my own personal stuff. How to make it an easier thing. The title is, I'll tell you one here, I'll try and keep it quick. Okay? Okay, I'll try and keep it quick. Well, if it is, I assume most people do have a tough time fasting. If you don't have a tough time fasting, then fine. Then it's not a problem. But I mean, wait. You want to go? You can go.
I have to leave.
Oh, you did good. So you came for the. You could have thought you could have had an easy time with all these. Don't call me if. Okay, the title of this is called No One Ever Died from Fasting on Yom Kippur. Okay? Now, a lot of it began from personal experience. Because when I was younger, I used to have a really tough time. I used to get terrible, terrible headaches. And to the extent, it was like I'd have to go home and lie down. And I couldn't, you know, like, with any physician, it was like your head is bursting and you get nauseous. It was, I had a tough time. And I just thought that, well, that's maybe because I was drinking coffee, whatever it is. But as over the years, I have a completely different opinion. And I think that most of it, I can't say all of it, I can't, there may be people that legitimately, for whatever their conditions, have a tough time fasting. But I think that 99% of it is psychological. And it's a certain type of anxiety. The way I discovered it myself was, I used to get very, very sick. Then when I got my first rabbi position, that's an inward, we have my third now. So I was really worried because I had to do a lot of things. And then the shul, I dive in the chakras, I had to make a speech, and I leaned. So I was really worried because I'm going to get sick. I assume I'm going to get sick like I always do. And it could be a big problem. Yeah, well, do people understand? Okay. What happened was I was extremely surprised that it was much easier. It wasn't as bad. That is, the more I did on that day, davening, as I said, and speaking, the more activity, which I thought, I can't do this, the more I did, the better I felt. Now, it didn't go away completely. I still would get headaches, but they weren't anything compared. And I was completely surprised. I was totally surprised. And over the years, it got better and better. So I had things, like now in my shul, for years I wanted to give a shiur in the afternoon during the break. And I wouldn't, you know, I feel tired. The last few years, I give shiur now, during the break, and then I dive a mincha for the Amid and I lane, and it's like nothing. So something which was a day of absolute misery, I couldn't do anything except, you know, just barely function or daven. It's become like a joke. Now, my idea is like this. It's the anxiety. There's nothing wrong with going 24 hours after. It's not a big deal, in reality. If God didn't impose something, but we overestimate it in our mind. And I'll tell you something else. For example, generally speaking, I don't eat all day. I only eat once a day, I eat at night. I don't eat breakfast, I have coffee, but I don't eat. I don't eat lunch. And if I'm giving a class in the, sometimes I have to give class in the evening, I go into Manhattan, I don't get home till about 9:30, 10, I don't eat. And I'm not even hungry. Until I come home, and then, you know, you kind of, you crash. But I mean, because as long as your mind is preoccupied, when your mind is occupied, I mean, it's probably like my experience. However, that's and you may have had the same experience as well. But comes Yom Kippur, right? It's the morning, like a half hour, and already you're feeling miserable. But why? I go a whole day without food. Why? Because it's not the absence of the food, it's the emotional state of deprivation. Knowing that I could eat, well, you can go for hours sometimes. You're busy, you've got a class, you can go for hours. You don't care. But that's because you know that you can't eat. On Yom Kippur, it's that sense of deprivation. We feel deprived. And because of that, you exaggerate in your mind. Now, have you ever noticed people, you know, like, people get together, you see Jews on Yom Kippur, it's like, you know, we're all huddling together, we're like under some kind of a nuclear attack, you know, like, how are you doing, how are you? It's like, everybody's like a survivor, my God, it's like this, I can't move too slowly, I can't move too quickly, I gotta save my energy, it's like, right? Well, there's only a certain amount of oxygen in the room, don't breathe, you're breathing, you're taking around, you know. Oh, well, thank God, I'm all right, okay, what time is it? No. It's all because you're convinced that something horrible is happening to you. If you want, well, you want corruption on every level. So the truth of the matter is, there's nothing, it's just the 24-hour day, it's going to be over, it's not a big deal. And you should be happy about it, because all your sins are going to be forgiven. You should be totally happy, it's not a big deal. It's nothing to go 24 hours, because you've convinced yourself that going for 24 hours without food is like the concentration camp, because you have that attitude, you can't, you're fighting it. You can't, so therefore, don't exaggerate it. The amount of pain is exaggerated, that causes the anger, that causes the headache. If you took your mind off of that, two things you must do. Take your mind off the fact that you're fasting. Do not allow yourself to feel any pity for yourself. When you start to feel that way, and when is it over, what am I going to do, and this next, cut that feeling. Do not allow yourself. Do not ask that other person how you do. Do not. I don't ask anyone how to do it, but there's nothing wrong. What the hell am I doing? You big deal. What's happening to me? Everything's fine. You're insured, bad condition, what's the problem? You didn't eat in a few hours? You see how people are ready at 10 o'clock, they're asking, what do you mean, so you haven't eaten for an hour? You eat a big meal before the fast. You got plenty of food in you. There's enough there to last. Believe me, you can go past. The truth of the matter is, another proof is, once it's over, there's been a big sigh of relief, and then if you're talking to someone, you don't have to rush home and eat. Did you notice the whole feeling changes? A lot of times the person is miserable all day. Then once the fast is over, he's relaxed. He has time. He gets home. Just mad. And then he doesn't, if a person was truly dying, he'd have to eat immediately. What happens as soon as it's over? Depression is gone. So it's all the pressure. It's not the objective. But you have to be convinced of that. You have to be convinced of the fact. So therefore, you have to be positive about it. You have to, it's like anything else. Let's say the plane is delayed. It's delayed. So it's 2 hours. Okay? So you have to see some people are miserable and sick. They can't get. And if you look at the big, what's the big deal? It's just a 2 hour thing. You can be there, right? So you take out a book of it. If a person has a relaxed attitude, that means if your mind, your attitude is in line with the actual reality, you can relax about it because nothing happens. It is of no consequence in the scheme of things. It's not going to change your life. But you see, some people are crazy because they can't tolerate any inconvenience. They start to complain and make a whole thing, and they make themselves miserable. So you get a headache. You wind up being miserable. The same thing over here. You're not going to believe me on this because you feel, you're so pampered and that need to be pampered. So what you have to do is do not at all cater to those emotions. When they come, do not ask your friend how they're doing because he's doing fine. And don't allow yourself to get, think, what do you do? Focus. Action. When you're involved in something, when you meet someone, a boy, a girl, and you're feeling together, you can go hours and hours, you don't even think about food. When you're preoccupied with something, you don't even think about food. Right? Who cares about food? I don't even think food. I just want to be with the person. Oh, what about the need for food? It's a psychological thing. So you have to be focused on activities. I'm not saying you have to be focused, first and foremost, on tefillos. Now, the more you can be involved in the tefillos, the more you're covering, the more... It's contrary, because the emotion is saying, I can't do. That's my emotion. I can't stop it. I'm fasting. How can I stop for the yamen? How can I lane that? The truth is, however, once I did that, I put all my energy in. The adrenaline kicks in, and then I'm not thinking about the fast. The fact that I'm fasting, I'm feeling 10 times better. And the time goes quickly. Because if you're just in that state of misery, it's forever. But if you're doing things, davening first and foremost, that's what the day is about. Be involved in the davening. I now stand the whole time. Stand as I stand. I'm not saying you have to do that. I do so because that's part of the thing, that the one who's davening from the other should be surrounded by others like a bestie. So I do it in my shul. I have to make the announcements. I'm constantly asking to announce this, and I'll explain what does this mean. The more active you are, and the more you have a positive attitude, you must convince yourself that this is a great day. I mean, seriously, not just that you can, to really see why it's a great day and be happy about it. Be careful. I was going around and some people were saying, come on, what's the matter? This is a happy day. Come on, sing. Let's start singing. Let's see some of the mirrors. Come on. What are you sad about? Now, I know this to a number of people. And those who, they said it helped a great deal. It may not be that in 1 year. I think it's, you build it up. Because it takes a time, it takes a while to convince yourself. I did the same thing on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is even harder, of course, in the summer. It's a longer day. I do the keynotes, I give a cheer in the afternoon, then I tell you, the more you do, the more you active, the better you're going to be. It's a day of activity. And there, again, do not think for a moment that you're in any kind of a state or bad state. There's plenty of food in there. And it's 24 hours is nothing. Just look at the whole picture. It's 24 hours a day. It's nothing. It'll be gone, and you're going to be fine. Nothing is going to happen, because no one ever died from fasting on Yom Kippur. So that's what I suggest. It's a psychological state. During the break, do not engage in any of these, you know, conversations where you're sort of like giving each other support groups. Support groups are forming of Yom Kippur. Just to carry each other through the day. That do not allow yourself to do that. You got a break? You want to take a nap? That's pretty good. Sometimes you're tired. Right, take a nap. Take a nap. If you can take a nap. Afterwards, take Gavra Chavrusa, learn. Learn. You know, be mentally involved. Look forward to this. Prepare the mincha. Get involved in the mincha. Daven, stand, etc. And do not allow yourself for one moment to entertain those thoughts that there's any kind of a problem over here. And I think that's going to, by putting yourself in a state of joy, by putting yourself in a state of optimism, and by completely not giving in to any suggestion that you're in a dangerous situation or you deserve any kind of sympathy, I think that's going to have a big effect on you. Okay, any questions, comments, anything? Huh? I wish I could see you guys on your trip. You're fine, you don't have a problem. Oh, well, Moses, interestingly enough, those who don't have problems, when you speak to them, they're people that have this attitude. They didn't have to be taught the attitude. They naturally had the attitude, and they realize it's not a big deal. But those who didn't, I think this is a big factor. And look, I don't want to be unsympathetic. There may be people that would have a real problem, okay? Whether it's migraine, whether it's allergies, or whether whatever their own, you know, blood sugar, whatever. I don't mean to disparage them. But I think by and large, healthy people that don't have any problems, you're driving yourself crazy. And also, you're missing out on the day. It should be a great day in which you really focus on the meaning of the day. Which, as I said, a lot of these people, that's why it's good to prepare. So the tefillos become more meaningful. But you see, you can go through some of the tefillos in English. Have Rabbi Soloveitchik's Machzor with great commentary. During the break, have a little learning thing. By acting in a manner which shows that I'm in great shape, it has an effect on your emotional attitude. Don't let yourself get into a bad attitude. There's plenty of stuff you can read. Aside from that, I mean, material which would be relevant to Yom Kippur to read. Okay? And to the contrary, the adrenaline factor, I attribute a lot to adrenaline. Getting up and giving a speech or a gun that brings out the adrenaline. The more you act, counterintuitive. The intuition is to protect yourself and cover up and huddle and not do. Act counter to that and act in a manner of, you know, doing things. But you have plenty of strength, you have plenty of energy. It's not true that, like I said, after the fast, you relax and go for an hour without. If you've got an important phone call, that you really want to talk, you'll spend another hour testing. How's that? After all the day, you couldn't wait till it was over, and now your broker called you about a thing, like you make money, and it's not, all of a sudden you're involved in that, you forget about the fact that you're testing. That's what you've got to do. You've got to forget about the fact that you're testing. Don't let that come to your consciousness. Okay, guys, that's it.
Rebbe?
Yeah.
The question.
Yeah.
So you talked about the idea of repetitive behavior to uproot a negative activity, that, you know, an avera. There's also the concept that you mentioned about looking into and seeing what's so wrong, for example, about the Lashon Hara. So the question is like this. How do the two come together? Do they work independently or do they work together? Meaning that if a person can see the negativity of a certain activity like Lashon Hara, does he need repetitive behavior also?
Yes. Most of the time, unless the person is on such a level of chachma that the emotions automatically go along with it. The divide is between intellectual apprehension and the emotional. So you can see something intellectually, but your emotions are still there. You can see how ridiculous, honor is, how childish it is. But the emotion is still attached to it. So you have to wean the emotions away. You have to wean the emotions away. You're educating the emotions. That's what I'm saying. That's how the two come together. You need both. You need the idea, the truth, but you need to see it intellectually. Now, if the person, again, if he's an individual who's so completely under the dominance of his mind, so the emotions will go automatically. But if he's not, then he's going to have to repeat the actions. Because the emotions are going one way, his mind is going... In other words, it's like we say, hey, take an episode about me, share, his year is greater than his chokhmah. You know that, right? That the person's emotions are greater than his chokhmah. You follow?
Right.
That many people are like that. They get up, they give a great shiur, and I did the ideas are great. But then look at their own life. In their own life, they're pursuing honor. You see? That means that their emotions are not in line with their knowledge. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, and theoretically, that makes sense. If the person sees it clearly, certain individuals, they could change on the dime. Certain people will take a little bit longer because it's not that clear. What about the opposite, where a person doesn't agree with them necessarily, but he will repeat the action of going to the other extreme? So, for example, a person doesn't see the truth in being charitable. He loves money, but he wants to repent, so he keeps on giving charity without agreeing that it's a truism. Will that help at all, just the repetition?
Oh, yeah, it'll help behaviorally, but he'll be losing out, because emotionally his emotions will be tied up with the wrong thing, but he's not giving into his emotions. There'll be a certain conflict. He's not getting the full benefit of the happiness. It should lead to a happiness. And that happiness is when the mind... See, that's the real perfection. The real perfection is when that's really what your Muslim Mashiach is, that the world will be filled with the knowledge of God, not just intellectually, but the emotions will be in line with that. Mm-hmm. So that's when people will not be able to harm anything, because they'll have the true ideas and the emotions will be in line with the truth. That's perfection. So you got to have both elements. It is possible for a greedy person to force himself to give charity, but he's not going to get the perfection on the same level. He'll get some benefit, but he'll be in a state of conflict.
So when the Rambam talks about going to the other extreme as being...
Going to the other extreme, I didn't really focus on that kind of thing. That's where the thing itself doesn't mean the good or bad, it's just that in moderation. That a person should indulge certain things in moderation. But when he goes to one extreme, so he has to uproot that, he goes to the other extreme to uproot it, then he has to educate himself back to the path of moderation. I was just using that as a basis, but I wasn't talking about doing that. I was talking about uprooting bad mitzvos from your character. I wasn't really talking about the path of moderation. I was just using that as an example. But since it works over there, I want to adapt the Rambam's repetitive phenomenon to this goal.
So when the person repeats the opposite behavior and he neutralizes it and he finds himself in the middle, then he's best fit to look at it more intellectually at that point. He has to still make that step intellectually.
Yes. The other one was talking about uprooting a disease. It's like a disease. Uh-huh. So that's, I didn't really focus on that, as I said.
Okay.
I just used that to show you the engine of change is the repetition.
Right.
Okay, Marshall.
Sure.
Take care. Thank you, everybody. Tomorrow, I'll see you later, everybody. We put back to me after we are Yom Kippur. What a great time you had.
Okay. Yeah. All right, thank you so much.
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, but...
So, Tina, you're asking, could you give an example of an emotion being aligned with the mind? Well, yeah, I mean, the example I was just discussing with Reverend Mann is let's say, a person who's really stingy with his money. So, in order to be charitable, he should look into his stinginess and see how beneficent he can be to other people. By giving his money, to them, and how it can benefit their lives. That intellectual, mind realization will cause his emotions to follow. Okay, Nomi in India, I see you just joined. The class just concluded, so you probably have the hour difference. But we're going to put it online. Again, I'll... I'm going to put it right here. So take a look at the last text entry. I just put in red the actual link. Where you'll be able to find this class. It'll be online in about 5 minutes. So this way, if anybody missed any part of the class, you'll be able to listen to it in full. Just go to that link, masora.org/audio, and you'll be able to hear the class in full. All right, I'm glad everybody was up to make it and enjoy the class. And we'll continue Sunday, where we're going to go into ideas about repentance. And we're actually going to discuss more about what Rabbi Mann had discussed about the four different levels of repentance. Just the level of just individual repentance, and then the need for Yom Kippur, then the need for afflictions in life, and finally the need for death as a repentance. And those four levels of need for of atonement are aligned with the level of corruption in the person. Okay, Tina, glad you enjoyed it. Naomi, I'm glad that you'll hear the class online. In about 5 minutes, you'll go to that link and you'll be able to hear it. And so if anybody else missed the class, so you can go to the link in red that you see, masora.org/audio. You'll be able to listen to the whole class in its entirety. It's a good class. All right, so I wish everybody a good week for the rest of the week and a good Yom Kippur. And again, we'll be resuming again Sunday morning at 11:15 a.m. That's U.S. Eastern Time. Okay, Josh, glad you can make it. Hope you're doing well. All right, good night to everybody. And again, we'll put the class online in about 5 minutes. You go to masora.org/audio. And you'll be able to hear the class in full. All right, good night to everybody.